Welcome to Basic Brewing Radio for Thursday, November 1st, 2018. I'm James Spencer. Here at Basic Brewing Radio, we're all about home brewing. This week, Dr. Chris Hamilton from Hillsdale College in Michigan joins us to talk about his experiments looking at the effect that wort gravity and hop stand temperature have on IBUs. Chris also follows up on the experiment that originally brought him to Basic Brewing Radio, using Clarity Firm to reduce the gluten levels in beer. If you go to basicbrewing.com, you can find archives of our audio and video shows, our DVDs, our brewer's logbooks, and other Basic Brewing gear, including our tie-dye silicone pint. You can follow me on Twitter and Instagram, at Basic Brewing, and find our show page on Facebook. We have a cool Basic Brewing app on iTunes and Amazon.com, and we're found all over the place where fine podcasts are served up. If you do us a favor of rating us on iTunes and maybe leaving a nice comment there, they say that that will help new listeners to find us. If you want to support us financially, check out patreon.com/basicbrewing. And thanks to all the new subscribers who are helping out. If you go to patreon.com/basicbrewing, you can see a long list of stuff that you can access if you sign up as a supporter. The Halloween video episode featuring my Booberry Tart Ale is out there. I shared a pint of it with my son Drew last night, and he liked it. I don't want to spoil the episode too much, but the beer did turn out better than I expected. It's it's still a little weird, which is fine. It's great for Halloween. I'm wondering what to do for next year's Halloween beer. I saw a limited edition box of Captain Crunch Halloween-themed cereal, so I may have to try to snag one of those. The Count Chocula that I used for last year's beer was a year old, and it didn't suffer from any age on that, so... If you have any ideas for weird Halloween beers that might also be tasty, please let me know. On a sadder note, I received some sad news from Tony Funk up in the Kansas City area. He sends us the news that Alberta Rager, owner and manager of Bacchus and Barleycorn, died this past Friday, October 26th. After retiring from teaching special education and mainstream elementary students, she began a second career teaching adults to brew beer, make wine, cider, mead, and cheese. She served as co-administrator of the fledgling Beer Judge Certification Program until it became an independent entity, and she was a member of the Board of Advisors of the American Homebrewers Association. And we met Alberta and interviewed her for this podcast way back in 2007, when we went up to cover a competition being hosted by the Kansas City Beermeisters. Very sad to hear of her passing. By the way, Alberta's husband, Jackie, is author of the Rager IBU formula. So our thoughts go out to him, all of our Alberta's family, friends, and fellow brewers. And I still have a pint glass from that competition, and I will raise it this evening in Alberta's honor. So thanks to Tony for letting me know. On to better news. I got some good comments on last week's show featuring the experiment that Alex Roberts and I did on wort chiller water flow. Brandon from Easley, South Carolina writes, "What I began doing, because my tap water won't chill below 88 degrees Fahrenheit, I got a cheap submersible water pump, a 30-gallon trash can full of ice." We have lots of those 20-pound $1 places here, and my immersion chiller. I pump the ice water through the chiller and collect it in a separate trash can to use on another batch if I'm brewing on the same day or for something else. I usually get my wort chill down to about 60 degrees Fahrenheit in about 20 minutes, and it only takes about half of the trash can of water to do it. And P.S., Brandon says, I wasn't paying attention one time and chilled my wort to 45 degrees Fahrenheit before I checked it. Oops. Thanks, Brandon. Neil from Ames, Iowa writes, "As a frugal brewer, I've tried several things to chill my wort quickly, but without using a large amount of water. I'm also something of a traditionalist, so I don't use any pumps, gravity only. I even once built a counterflow chiller, but after trying to use it a couple of times and measuring how much water I used, over 60 gallons, I gave it up and went back to my tried and true method." Neil says, "My tried and true method is to save ice from my home ice maker every evening for a week And when I'm ready to chill my wort, I fill a 6-gallon pot with ice, then fill it with water. I then just set it somewhere higher than my brew kettle, get the water siphoning through the chiller and into a pot on the ground, and stir the wort almost constantly, occasionally topping up the pot of ice water. It rarely takes more than half an hour to take the wort from close to boiling to below 70 degrees Fahrenheit, and I only use about 10 to 12 gallons of water. Wow. Neil says, I really think that stirring constantly helps rather than only a few stirs every 5 minutes, and putting colder water through the chiller makes a large difference too. Well, thanks, Neil. Alex and I really are going to have to follow up on that stirring thing, the stirring question. I was surprised by the result that we found. John writes in with this. Hey, James and Steve, just dropping you a little note to say I purchased my brew-in-a-bag system from High Gravity. It should be here within a couple days. Appreciate the information and reviews y'all did on it. Can't wait to get it and start brewing. Congratulations, John. I know you'll enjoy your system as much as I like mine, from our friends and sponsors, Desiree and Dave of High Gravity in Tulsa. I'm hearing more and more from brewers who are taking the pain out of propane and going electric with a High Gravity system with a Warthog controller, especially as the weather turns colder. You don't want to have to stand out by the brew pot or mash tun 100% of the time babysitting it. The Warthog controller takes the worry and guesswork out of hitting and maintaining mash temps, and when it comes time to boil, all the heat from the element goes right into the wort instead of blowing away with the breeze. And the past two batches I've used with my system, I did sort of a sous vide sort of thing. For the Booberry Tart Ale, I inoculated my wort with probiotics and then held it at 110 degrees Fahrenheit. That's 43°C. For 2 days while it soured. For the latest experiment with Imperial's Loki yeast, I held a 6.5-gallon carboy at 90 Fahrenheit or 32°C during primary fermentation. So, ease of use, flexibility, portability, what's not to like? Check out all the electric systems from 2 to 3 vessels and 5 gallons to 2 barrels at highgravitybrew.com and use the code EBC75BB. To save $75 off your electric gear purchase. That's highgravitybrew.com. Okay, you'll remember Chris Hamilton from his experiments with Clarity Firm and its effects on reducing gluten in beer. Well, now Chris is back to share experiments on IBUs in wort as they are affected by wort gravity and hop stand temperature. So if you want to follow along, find a link to his PDF in the description of this episode on basicbrewingradio.com or by tapping the bonus button in your Basic Brewing app. Chris Hamilton, welcome back to Basic Brewing Radio.
Hi, James. Good talking with you again.
I can't even remember when we last met. It's a few years ago.
Yeah, it was at the when the American Homebrewers Association meeting was in Grand Rapids, and we met in a lovely hotel room.
Yeah. And your experiment that you shared with us then was on the effect of Clarity Firm on gluten in beer. And I have to say that that was one of the most impactful experiments, or at least influential experiments. Mm-hmm. Several people have been impacted by your results. In a good way.
I hope not. Anyway.
In a good way. It's not always good to be impacted, but, you know.
No.
but really, the results of that experiment have made, some positive impacts mm-hmm. on brewing, both on the yeah. professional and homebrew scale.
Yeah, it's good to see. And, after your show, we did the stuff on beerandwinejournal.com, too, and that was been read a lot. And I know we've talked by email a lot, and I've gotten a lot of emails about that since. And so we've actually carried on some of that research, too, over the years. And I can tell you a little bit about that if you're interested.
Yeah, let's get an update.
So for people that haven't heard the show, but is about, using Clarity Firm, which is also known as Brewer's Clarex, and using that to break down gluten in beer to essentially make a beer with very reduced gluten, something close to gluten-free or as close as you can get using barley or wheat. And so our results, and you guys did the tasting on the show, and the experimental results that we did showed that the beer essentially had, you know, undetectable levels of the little proteins that are left over from gluten. Essentially, the way the enzyme works is by chopping up into little tiny pieces, so that some of those pieces are still left over, but the idea is that they won't cause a problem to someone who has celiac disease. And so one thing that was really interesting is I've had some students continue that work, and one thing was kind of one of these accidental findings. I had a student, we wanted to use a different yeast, and so we saw these mangrove jack yeast came out a few years ago in the U.S. market, and we tried those, and actually the results weren't as, you know, pretty. I mean, everything was still reduced, but it was a little bit higher. You know, some of the things were above the 20 parts per million level. We could detect it. And, you know, looking at the beer, I could clearly tell that the yeast was still in suspension. It didn't flocculate nearly as much. And we intentionally don't use any fining agents because we want the enzyme, you know, we don't want to like bias it in any sort of way. We want just the enzyme to be doing things. And so we thought, well, maybe the yeast flocculation is playing a role. And so this past summer, when my students, who also did some of the hop work we'll talk about later, we actually used yeast with different levels of flocculation. And we found that the yeast that is, you know, the really high flocculators, we essentially got, you know, undetectable levels of gluten again. But in the yeast that, you know, we tried to Hefeweizen yeast, you know, that actually, again, it had very reduced levels of gluten, but it was more detectable. Hmm. So, you know, again, you know, we've got to repeat some of these experiments, but the evidence certainly seems, you know, if you're trying to do this to reduce gluten because, you know, you're someone with celiac disease that can tolerate these gluten, you know, reduced beers, that, you know, you probably want to be using a yeast that has higher flocculation. But again, you know, if you're using things like, you know, Irish moss or roll flock, if you're using gelatin and all these to clarify your beers, then it's probably not as important. But our hypothesis is that, you know, yeast are known to bind to a lot of things, and probably the yeast are binding to some of the proteins that are in the beer, and, you know, gluten and the barley coradines, these are proteins. And so we think what might be happening is since they're binding to the yeast, that it's not accessible for the enzyme to break them down. So either by, you know, by clearing your beer and getting rid of the yeast, you're helping reduce the amount of gluten or hordein that's in the beer. So either, you know, using a higher flocculant yeast or using fining agents to kind of cut those down.
I was going to ask what impact that would have on hazy beers, but I guess with hazy beers, you're probably not going to be using ClarityFirm because you want them hazy.
Right. I mean, well, it depends. And, you know, the thing is, you know, ClarityFirm is really designed to, I mean, the initial reason for it was to, you know, get rid of chill haze. It wasn't meant to be a fining agent like, you know, Whirl Flock is, or like some of these other products are, even like Isinglass. It's doing a different sort of thing. So I think a lot of people, you know, don't know what it was originally for. It's like, if you had a hazy IPA recipe and had a ClarityFirm, it's still going to be a hazy beer. You know, whatever the yeast is doing in your hazy beer, that's a different story. And something that we're still trying to work out exactly what's going on.
So for those still not brewing, like the zero tolerance guys or the guys and gals from that home brewing club, they're brewing gluten-free beers with no gluten in
right.
their ingredient list at all. But for those who are still brewing, you know, typical beers, traditional beers, and then wanting them to be as gluten-free as possible for their the people that they're serving, having a more flocculent yeast sounds like the way to go.
Yeah, I would definitely recommend that. And certainly, you know, use your fining agents, use Whirl Flock or Irish Moss or something like that as well. Again, using the enzyme, it should, you know, chew up most of the proteins. But again, you know, 99.9% is good enough for most people with, you know, that have gluten intolerance, but, you know, for some people, they are really hypersensitive to them. So I think, you know, the zero tolerance guys, for some people, if they want beer, that's all they can do. But I know a lot of people that do have celiac disease, like my mother-in-law, you know, they cheat occasionally, they'll have birthday cake and they'll be, you know, that kind of thing. And they're okay. But some people, you know, they have a single, like, you know, grain of gluten and, you know, they have a severe reaction. So I think for those kind of people, the zero tolerance stuff they're doing is right along the right lines. But I think most, you know, I'm not a medical doctor, so don't take this as a prescription. But I think, you know, if people that have celiac disease certainly should be working with their doctors. I've heard people have talked to their doctors, and a lot of them have given them the go-ahead to either, you know, for home brewing or to drink some of those omission beers that are on the market, or the Stone, their kind of reduced gluten beer. And, you know, as long as you're not drinking a keg of it a day, they're not having kind of side effects from that. I think the alcohol might be a bigger problem with a keg a day. But
yeah, there may be other issues.
Yeah. Have no liver left. You
know. Yeah. Yeah. As we talked about in the with the toxicologist Paul episodes, you know, there is something toxic in beer, and it's ethanol. It's the yeah. So keep that in mind. Well, very nice. Are you ready to talk about hops and IBUs?
Sure.
Now, you recently attended an event.
Yes.
Actually presented at the event. Where'd you go? What'd you do?
So I went to the European Brewing Convention, their Recent Advances in Hop Science Symposium, which was in September. It was actually primarily in Nuremberg, Germany. So I got to present some work there that one of my students named Chris Huffman did with me this past year. And so we were primarily looking at, you know, hops and looking at the effect on IBU utilization. Looking at changes in gravity of the beer as well as changes in the temperature.
And before we get to your results, what was the buzz around the conference this year?
You know, there were a lot of people really interested in, you know, bitterness units, especially related to hazy IPAs. My talk was one of the motivating factors for my work was, you know, Newland IPAs, which I love as a style and the flavor from the hops, but how does that bitterness work in? And so there were several talks related to that. Actually, John Lanzini, who does Schilling Brewery, he gave a great talk, and I got to talk to him quite a bit about that. And Tom Shellhammer, which is a name some people might recognize from Oregon State, he gave a nice talk, as well as a few of his students as well. And there was some interesting work, too, from one of his students on dry hopping, and something that a lot of people had seen before. But enzymes in the hops actually have amylase activity, and kind of tied in with some of John Lanzini's work, too, that they actually saw a decrease in the gravity of the beers that were dry hopped versus those that weren't. And so they were actually getting, you know, a little bit more alcohol out of those beers. And so that was some really cool stuff. And then there was also a lot of interest, especially on the second day, about hop breeding and kind of, you know, all the hop breeding that's going on in Europe and kind of the influences there. Both worries about like verticillium and kind of resistance to that, as well as with, you know, potential climate change. They've been having a lot of droughts and intense heat in parts of Europe. So how can they breed hops to kind of combat some of those issues? And so it was a great conference overall. And we had a lot of fun, and we got to go see a hop yard in Spalt and got to see them actually harvesting hops because we were there at just the right time of the year for that.
Oh, nice.
Somebody must have been planning ahead when they came up with the date for the conference.
So. Yeah, that's fun. I've seen hops harvested a couple of times, and it's amazing. You don't realize how big and tall those those binds can get.
Yeah, it was a lot of fun, and everybody's standing around watching it. And of course, you know, they had some good German beer for us to drink while we watched them harvest hops. So it was a lovely evening.
There's no good beer in Germany, is there?
there's a few, you know, if you know where to look. You know,
they're just getting started.
Every restaurant, every grocery store, you know, every bar.
Oh, yeah. I'm jealous. I'm jealous, Chris. Well, let's talk about what you did. You covered two areas. First of all, the effect on gravity of the wort on IBU utilization or hop utilization. So
right.
what was your methodology? How did you figure this stuff out?
So, the big experiment, essentially what we did is we brewed a lot of beer, but we did it on a small volume. And so since we were doing so many samples, we did basically effectively 1 liter batches of beer. And we wanted to do this with different hops, and we wanted to do it at different gravities. So for the first set of experiments looking at gravity, we actually did 64 separate batches of beer. We would do like four at a time, but that was still a lot of brewing going on. And so to simplify things, we didn't do all grain. We use the same brand of Muttons dried malt extract to make up our worts for our beer. And we didn't actually ferment anything. That's something I should point out too, is we're looking just at the wort. That's important because when we're talking about bitterness later on, that's a little bit different than most people are thinking about. So for the gravity work, we did four different gravities. And so we made beer that was, we did it in Plato, but I'll give you the conversions in a little bit. We wanted to do Plato because that's where most of the brewing science is. And it was in talk was in Germany as well, which is what everybody over there is using. So we did the beer, the wort gravity at 5 Plato, 10 Plato. The goal was to get to 15 and 20 Plato. We didn't quite hit those. But the idea was to give us a wide range of gravities. And for those of you know, you aren't used to the Plato scale, a 5 Plato wort is about, 10-20. And a 10 Plato would be about 10-40. It's not quite linear. 15 Plato is about 10-61, and 20 Plato is about 10-83. One thing I should say is that was our goal when we started out. And so we calculated the amount of dried malt extract we'd have to add to water. We ended up boiling these all for 2 hours. Mm. And so because we wanted to do, because a lot of people will do a 2 hour boil to try to get, better hop utilization. And so we had to kind of, figure out how much boil off we were going to get. And so we based our boil off experiments on like, the 5 Plato, 10 Plato worts. And, for those, we hit those pretty dead on. We knew, okay, it takes about, we start off with about, 1.45 liters of water, add our dried malt extract, and then we get to, after 2 hours, get to 1 liter. Well, we did those same calculations for the 15 and 20 Plato, but we actually didn't get as much boil off. Should have thought ahead, it's a much thicker solution, so it's actually going to boil off more slowly because there's more sugar present. But in the end, it just didn't matter that much because, okay, we had a 14.5 Plato wort and a 17.5 Plato wort. Those numbers are just as good to use for analysis as 5, 10, 15, and 20. They just, don't have the nice round, effects to them.
Mm-hmm.
So what we ended up doing is we chose two different hops for these experiments. So we had those four gravities and we brewed everything in duplicate. And we used both Cascade hops and Citra hops. So we wanted to use hops that had kind of different alpha acid percentages. And so the Cascade hops, I'm thinking we're around 7 or 8% alpha acids, and the Citras were just over 13% alpha acids. And so what we did then, and slow me down if I'm missing some details for you, but what we did is we would do an individual gravity. And so if we wanted to do our 5 Plato beers that day, we would do 4 or 5 Plato beers, and we would add different amounts of a single hop to them. So our one, we'd add 0.5 gram of hops to, and then 1 gram of hops, and then 2 grams of hops, and then 3 grams of hops. And we'd have those four beers going that day or that part of the day. And then we'd repeat that with, so we'd do it twice with Cascade at that gravity, repeat that twice with Citra at that gravity, and repeat that. And then we would do all the other the gravities of the beer. And so that's obviously a lot of beer, and you think, okay, 64 different beers for that. Well, the important thing, how are we going to test the hop utilization? So what we did is we had to do IBU analysis. And you've had several people on before that have talked about this. But we wanted to really follow, how quickly do things happen? I mean, there's a lot of questions. Most people, your listeners, are probably familiar with like the Tinzeth formula. There's also the Rager and a few other ones. And, a lot of these formulas are, 20, 30 years old. And they weren't done using pellet hops, which is what we were using. And that was one of the questions is, how does our data fit with what the Tinzeth formula is? So using pellet hops for this, I think, kind of filled in some of that. And the goal was, do we see the same kind of thing? And so we took time points throughout that entire 2 hours. So we took a time point literally 1 minute after we added the hops, 5 minutes after we added the hops, 10 minutes after we added the hops. And then, every 10 minutes up to an hour in 60 minutes, and then 75, 90, 105, and 120 minutes. So we got, 13 time points for basically every single one. And, you can do the math, multiply 13 times 64. We did a lot of IBU analysis this past summer doing this. And so, one sort of, initial finding we thought that was kind of surprising was that we ended up seeing the IBU numbers were much higher than we initially expected based upon what we'd seen with the tensor formula, but also the initial rate. You know, we saw the rate within 5 or 10 minutes. There were significant detectable IBUs in these wort samples. And that really, by the time we got to 40, 50 minutes, you know, we were close to the top of, you know, where our IBUs would be. And so by 2 hours, you know, the change wasn't that different. And, you know, one thing of talking with Tom Shellhammer at the EBC Hop Conference was that his thought was that it's possible, and again, we have to do the experiment here, that when you're doing this, you know, we didn't use any sort of, you know, hop spider or anything like that. We just threw the pellets in. And for those of your listeners who've used hop pellets, you know that pretty much it just, you know, turns into like dust when as soon as you add it, and it's just, you know, kind of all over the place in the wort when it's boiling. And so, you know, compared to hop cone, you are going to have a lot more surface area. If you would expect a faster conversion from alpha acids to isoalpha acids in the beer or in the wort, but it still was, you know, that didn't explain the whole thing. And so he thought that maybe what's happening is, even though we would pull our samples out using a pipette out of every time sample, and we would take about 6 mils out, and we'd immediately put it into a tube and ice it. And they were pre-chilled tubes. The idea is we want to lower the temperature to be, you know, as close to 0 degrees Celsius as we can, as quickly as we can. And, you know, probably within, you know, within like maybe 2 minutes, you know, that those samples were cold. Mm-hmm. And then we would throw them in the fridge after that. So that the idea that, you know, there might be a little bit of a lag with the temperature, but it dropped really quickly. You know, his thought was, even though we were doing that, is that there might be some really fine particulate hops that are still suspended in solution, which might be actually, you know, like, well, you're not going to convert any anything to isoalpha acids at that point. But something I learned from John Lanzini was that, you know, when you're dry hopping, you actually your IBUs in your beer stay about the same, but the isoalpha acids in the beer actually drop, and the alpha acids that are dissolved actually go up. So alpha acids were interestingly a little bit more soluble in these cold temperatures, and so that maybe we're seeing a little bit of that going on over time. So we definitely need to look at you know, maybe possibly doing some filtration, seeing does that give us a difference.
I'm looking at this chart, and I'll post a link to your PowerPoint presentation in the description of this episode on basicbrewingradio.com. And if you have the app, you can click on the little bonus thing button there on this episode and find it. But if you look at this chart that says E1, time versus total IBU, the level of bitterness jumps up. I mean, it jumps up and is a flat line, like within what? 15 minutes?
It gets up there, you know, really quick. I mean, depending on which one you're looking at, really by maybe 20 minutes, the increase is really slow after that point. Really, in most cases, by about 40 minutes, 40, 50 minutes, you're kind of at the maximum kind of total IBUs. And if anybody's looking at the slides later on, I say total IBUs. Essentially, normally when you think of IBUs, it's more of a concentration, but we kind of factored in, well, what's the actual volume of the beer? You know, because we were looking at the sample throughout, you know, over time, well, the volume of the beer at 40 minutes is different than the volume of the beer at 2 hours. And so essentially what we did is we took the IBU concentration and then multiplied that by the volume of beer to get our kind of total IBUs. So if that makes sense, you know, like a simple illustration is, if you had a 2 liters of 50 IBU beer, well, 2 times 50, you'd have 100 IBUs. Or if you had 1 liter of 50 IBU beer, in both cases, you'd have 50 total IBUs, even though the concentrations were very different.
So the beer might be getting more bitter over time, but just because there's more of a concentration of the isomerized alpha acids.
Right. Yeah. You're just concentrating it more, but you're not really making more isoalpha acids.
So while the beer may be more bitter, you're not getting better utilization of those hop materials. It's just that there's more of them in that limited space.
Right. Yeah. And there is a table in my PowerPoint that kind of, you know, describes, people can kind of read along with that a little bit and kind of see, it's like, oh, well, if you really look at the utilization, doesn't look that, you know, different over time, you know, once you get to that you know, kind of 40, 50 minute, the utilization is not as great. But if you actually looked at the hop, you know, the concentration, it's like, oh, at 1 minute, it's 26 IBUs. At 2 hours, it's 66. That's huge. But really, the when you factor in the volume, the difference isn't that big over time.
So what's your takeaway? I mean, what effect does gravity have on hop utilization?
So so when we looked at our IBU results for the different hops, looking at different gravities, you know, first I looked at the data and it like didn't look like it all lined up quite right. And I plotted it out a few different ways. And then I started to really see a really linear trend when I was kind of factoring in, you know, the actual concentrations of everything. And so what I was looking at is, okay, well, we know how many grams of hops we're adding, and we know the alpha acid concentration. So we can actually figure out how many milligrams of alpha acids are we adding to each beer. And so when we looked at that, we saw a really clear linear trend that as the gravity increased, there was this kind of really steady linear decrease in the IBUs in the beer. And so we were actually able to plot this out and kind of came up with a formula, and it's in the spreadsheet there, but I can kind of, you know, translate a little bit of it for your listeners to make it a little clearer. But essentially, I'll give you the number that's in the spreadsheet, but it's about 0.0116, you know, kind of is the number of the utilization, plus there's a little off factor. But what that means is for every 0.0116 IBUs per milligram per liter of alpha acids, you get, I think I said that weird, if you want to fix that in post, but for every increase in gravity, for every degree Plato increase in gravity, so about every four points, if you're using gravity points, for every, you know, you're seeing the utilization drop by 0.0116 IBUs per milligram per liter. And I know that's a little convoluted if you're just listening to that. So I wrote out kind of a simplified version of it to kind of put it in units that might make sense to somebody brewing a batch of beer. So what that means, if you're brewing a 5-gallon batch of beer, that's about 23 liters, if I did my math right. And so 1 ounce of 10% alpha acid hops is actually about 2.83 grams of alpha acids. It's 28.3 grams of hops times 10%. So that's 2,830 milligrams. And if you divide that by the volume, which was 23 liters, your beer would have 122 milligrams of alpha acids per liter if they all went into the wort. So that's kind of your theoretical maximum of using 1 ounce of those hops in a 5-gallon batch of beer. So theoretically, if you got all those converted, you'd have 122 IBUs in your beer. Now, from our experimentation, you know, depending on the gravity of your beer, you'd see different things. So if we were doing a 5 Plato beer or 10-20, we would actually see about 57 IBUs from that wort. If we were doing a 10 Plato beer, it would drop by 7 IBUs. That'd be down to about 50 IBUs. And then a 15 Plato beer would be about 43 IBUs. And a 20 Plato beer would be about 36 IBUs. So when you're looking at a beer that's going from 10-20 to 10-80, the same amount of hops, you're looking at a difference of over 20 IBUs. And if you look at the Tinsmith model, it's not that far off from what we're looking at. The numbers were a little bit different there. They kind of started a little bit lower. The decrease in IBUs wasn't quite as great. But I think when I plugged in some numbers for a similar beer, it was coming out to maybe a decrease of about 17 or 18 IBUs. And so we saw a 21 IBU difference in our work. So I think it does show that the Tinsmith formula, well, it's not perfect. If people are using it to kind of, you know, do some of these kind of rough approximations, they're probably not too far off from the truth if they figure things out. But the thing to keep in mind, too, is we're looking at the wort IBUs. And so I tried actually, you know, talking to some people about it that know about the Tinsmith formula. And you know, it's unclear if that work was done to wort or to actually a fermented beer. Because for those people that have tested wort, the IBUs in wort are always going to be higher than the IBUs in the finished beer. So if you take a sample of your beer before you add yeast and send it out to be analyzed, and then you ferment it and send it to be analyzed, you're going to get two different numbers. Because the yeast in the fermentation process, I talked earlier about how yeast binds to proteins. Well, the yeast is probably also binding to some of these hop compounds. And so the yeast is actually reducing the bitterness in most beers. And if you look at some of my data, in some of the cases, you know, in the wort, we're getting 140 IBUs. You never see 140 IBUs in a finished beer. Mm-hmm. You know, the most you're ever going to see is maybe 100. And so, you know, the yeast are known to probably take out, in some cases, you know, more than 30% of those IBUs. So that's a thing to keep in mind when you're looking at these numbers or other people that are testing, you know, the wort, is you're going to see much higher numbers with that than you might expect initially.
Now, so if you're brewing a big old thick beer, put more mm-hmm. hops in.
Which, you know, most people have that general idea, but the idea is we wanted to be able to come up with a way to say, okay, if you want to get the same, you know, number of IBUs, you know, how much more do you really need? You know, if you really love the a pale ale that you've made, and you're like, you know, let me, you know, amp this up and make a double IPA out of it. So let me, you know, double almost everything in there. Well, for the bitterness, you're probably going to have to more than double, you know, your hops to get kind of the same level there, at least if you're looking just at the bitterness part of it. Mm-hmm. And obviously, some of the other work we did on temperature is going to play into that a little bit. But, you know, we wanted to kind of come up with a way to say, you know, can we really, you know, get these numbers down and figure out what's going on so that people can be more predictive? And our hope is that, you know, we can verify some of this stuff in the next next year, hopefully, and maybe actually get this published in an academic journal, and, you know, maybe share that and, you know, kind of come up with, and there's a lot of people coming up with some modified versions of the Tinsmith formula in that. I've seen some that really recommend, you know, drops over time in the IBUs, and I don't think that's really happening at up to 2 hours. I don't think we're really seeing degradation of IBUs at that point, but if we, you know, kind of, you know, look ahead, you know, can we come up with a way to either improve the Tinsmith formula or come with a new formula really using, you know, hop pellets? Or, you know, how are, and we don't know this yet, but, you know, how are some of these new cryo hops and how are all these things kind of playing into the bitterness game? Because, and especially as we look at New England IPAs and late hopping, you know, how many IBUs do you get from a 5 minute boil or from just steeping? And so that's kind of one of the other questions we were trying to look at this time.
Yeah, are we going to see a Hamilton formula out there?
I don't know. Maybe someday we'll have to see how if we can repeat the work. You know, I'll be happy to. You know, once I mean, obviously this has all been repeated, but once we do some of the filtration stuff, once we do a little bit more with the temperature analysis, you know, if I have enough to get it published in an academic journal, I'll do that first, and then I can put the data online for people to kind of, you know, play around with themselves, and maybe we can come up with. I told my student who did the work that I have to give him at least half the credit because of that formula. So it had to be the Hamilton-Huffman formula.
It's starting to sound like a comet or an asteroid. Now, yeah, you know my frustration with the IBU formulas. You know, well, my beer, you know, I used Tinsmith and my IPA didn't fit in the style guidelines, so I switched over to Daniels and it fit just fine. So.
You know, I mean, if people are consistent with what they're using, knowing your system, I mean, I think one of the problems with the Tinsmith formula too is intentionally when Glenn Tinsmith came up with it, he put in some adjustment factors for people's own systems. And if you use a lot of these websites, they don't have the default way to change these numbers around. Mm. So you're kind of stuck with kind of the default. I mean, one thing that bothers me with some of these formulas is they have, oh, click a button for hop cones or hop pellets, and there's a different number. Well, he never did any work with hop pellets. And actually, so all the number of hop pellets, people say, oh, they're about 10 to 15% more. And when I started this work, I kind of just looked online and plugged in the exact same recipe into about 8 different IBU calculators using the so-called Tinsmith formula. And I got 7 different answers from 8 different calculators. So if you're using a calculator, just stick with one, and, you know, evaluate your beers. And if you brew a beer, you want it more bitter, you know, increase your hops that way. can at least tell you, you know, if you're kind of, you know, using, you know, what we found with the gravity that, at least we can say with hot pellets, we kind of pretty much have a pretty good idea of what's going on, there. Now, there is a related issue that we're still trying to work out is, okay, we see a decrease in gravity. Why does hop utilization decrease with gravity? And actually, Some people are big proponents of it's the protein in the beer. And some people are big proponents of it's the sugar in the beer. And some people say it's both. I say that's a great idea for another set of experiments. And so that's probably what one of the things we're going to try to work on next summer is, can we nail that down? Is it both? Is it really the protein? If I had to lean in one direction or another, I'd say it's probably the protein. I know Glenn Tinzik is a big proponent of it being more sugar. That's kind of what he based his model off of. So
could it just be a saturation factor? I mean, there's just so much stuff in the liquid at some point, it can't hold much more?
I mean, certainly there can be to some extent, but you're looking at saturation of sugar or protein compared to already something that's just at the part per million level. So it's probably, could it be playing a role? It could be, but I don't think that would be a huge role in it, just at the concentrations you're looking at. Because obviously, IBUs are basically like a parts per million. So, 50 parts per million versus 45 parts per million solubility wise isn't that huge of a difference. So could it be playing a role? It could. I don't really know. But I think hopefully if we do the experimentation, we'll be able to really, come up with a real answer. It won't be just a bunch of people waving their hands saying, oh, it must be this, it must be that. So
it's like my sister's sweet tea. She put so much sugar in it that if she added, one more grain, it would crystallize. And I need to take a gravity on my sister's sweet tea.
Yeah, just put too much ice in it, solid block. Yeah.
Now, you also talked about, in this day and age where everybody is brewing beers and not putting them in the boil, putting hops in the boil, but waiting until after the flame out and putting, there's talk about, throwing IBU calculation formulas for a loop. Somebody asked me online on one of my videos I posted, they said, well, I want to make one of these beers. How do I figure out the bitterness? And I was like, I don't know. Just put the exact number of hops I did, and it tastes pretty good. So you did what your other segment of the test mm-hmm. was looking at the effect that basically hop stands at different temperatures
right.
Have on IBUs.
Yeah. So essentially our setup for the experiment was very similar to what we did for the gravity work, except we just stuck with one gravity of the beer. We kind of followed the same recipe we did for our 10 Plato beer, but we didn't actually boil it for 2 hours. We kind of just boiled it for a few minutes with no hops in it. Got it to a boil, and then we reduced the temperature. And so we did it at 70 degrees Celsius, 80 degrees Celsius, and 90 degrees Celsius. So if you're stuck on Fahrenheit, you can do your own conversions.
Well, okay, 70 would be about 160, 80 would be about 180, 90 is around what, 195?
Yeah, that sounds about right.
And then 100 is boiling.
Right, 100 is boiling 212 degrees Fahrenheit.
Depending on your altitude.
Right. And for every 10 degree drop in Celsius, it's an 18 degree drop in Fahrenheit, if you want to do the math that way. So we're looking at a difference of 18 degrees Fahrenheit or 10 degrees Celsius in each of these beers. And again, for those of you that look at the slides that James posting for my presentation, I put the boiled kind of wort data along with all the lower temperature data, so you can kind of see. And again, we saw very quick increases in IBUs, even at minute number one in these beers. We're seeing significant IBUs, and so with the hop stand beers, it's not different. We still saw in all of the reduced temperature worts, like the hop stand beers, we saw IBUs. Now the numbers, kind of at 1 to 5 minutes. Are probably we're all about half of what we saw in the boiled beer. But interestingly, the data, looking at it, initially the 90 degree was a little bit higher than the 80. The 80 was a little bit higher than the 70 for maybe the first 5 to 10 minutes. But after that, really the difference between temperature for IBUs between 70 degrees Celsius and 90 degrees Celsius wasn't that big. And there's some error and fluctuation. And I did post error bars on there too. So you can see that, really it's hard to tease out exactly, why are we not seeing a big difference, the temperature. The 70 and the 90 aren't that far apart. And when you add in the error and our averages, all of them look to be really close to the same. And I think from what I've heard from some people that have brewed a lot of these hop stand beers, they haven't really noticed that big of a flavor difference between, say, doing 70 and 90 degrees Celsius. But is the flavor, the aroma, some people say they can't, some people say they can tell the difference between 10 degrees. If it's, you know, 180 degrees Fahrenheit and or versus 160, they can tell the difference. But I think there's, it's complicated because obviously at those points, there's different things going on with the proteins. There's different things going on with the essential oils that are in the hops. It was clear that really the bitterness is with you know the lower temperatures was about kind of half of what we saw up to about 20 minutes. So if we did a 20-minute hop stand, comparing that to say 100 degrees Celsius boiling wort, it was about half of that. But we did extend some of these for up to 40 minutes, and if we did the 40-minute hop stand, in some cases, you know, again there's some error bars in there, but we're approaching, in some cases, 70 to 80% of the IBUs that we see in boiled wort in these. Now, again, we're looking at IBUs. I should be clear to note that IBUs doesn't always mean isoalpha acids. And I think what we might actually be seeing in some of these beers, while the IBUs are the same, and I think it's still useful to use that, is we might be looking at more alpha acids dissolved in the beer. And we might be seeing some oxidized alpha acids, which are an area of a lot of interest right now, too, because they're known to add bitterness to the beer. And if you're actually oxidizing those alpha acids, they're going to be picked up by the IBU analysis as well. And so they may, you might have the same number of IBUs, but the perceived bitterness might actually be a little bit lower. And that does kind of fit in with what people are seeing with some of these New England and hazy IPAs is that, you know, the amount of hops they add and the bitterness aren't quite the same as you get from a kind of standard West Coast type IPA. And so, you know, again, it's still an area where I think we need to do more research. I think looking at filtration of some of these worts might help explain some of that. And one thing that I think really needs to be done is really doing the full-on analytical analysis, doing all the separation and separating out by a method called HPLC, looking at how many actual isoalpha acids, how many oxidized alpha acids, how many alpha acids, how many beta acids are you really getting into there. So getting into some kind of really more serious chemistry to kind of answer those questions. But I think looking at just these IBU analyses definitely tells us that, you know, that you don't need to be boiling your wort to get IBUs. You know, for the hop stands, you really are getting IBUs out of these hop stands. And, you know, if people wanted, you know, a general rule of thumb, you know, I would say that about a 20-minute hop stand is going to give you somewhere around, you know, 60 to 70% of the IBUs you get from boiling. And that's a lot more. And, like, if you look at the Tinsmith formula, it counts at a zero. I think I know some of the software out there, I know Beersmith does this, will kind of calculate in a hop stand IBUs for you. I'm not exactly sure what formula he's using to do that, but you know, I think that it's definitely an area where we can kind of improve some of these formulas and hopefully make things a little bit more predictable for your brewers if they're trying to do this. You know, if you want to change up your hops, you know, is it really the essential oils you care about? You know, do you want to just throw in a ton of mosaic because it smells great? Or do you want to be a little bit more careful about, you know, that? Do you want to try to use some cryo hops because maybe it adds less hop matter or things like that? So I think it, you know, the great thing about it is it gives a lot of reasons to do more experiments, which as a scientist is a good thing.
And as a beer drinker, I think it's
exactly
a good thing too. Steve and I did a little experiment, a sensory experiment. We don't have fancy equipment like you and lab assistants, but we we did a hop stand experiment where I did extract beers with hops added at you know, three different temperatures. I think it was like 200, 180, and 160 maybe. And we did perceive a difference. And those were hop stands at 30 minutes, and we did perceive a distance or a difference in the character of those beers. So, are you saying that total IBU is a number that measures a certain quantity of hop stuff that's in the beer, but depending on the temperature that you steep, you may get different characteristics of that hop stuff? In other words, some of it might be more isomerized than at other temperatures, and you might get more perceived bitterness as opposed to, you know, more hop flavor or aroma or such as that.
Yeah, I think that's the big thing, at least. If you're comparing, 90 degrees to 70 degrees, you're probably getting more iso alpha acids from the 90 degrees. But in both cases, you're still getting an increase in the IBUs. So what the other hop stuff is it oxidized alpha acids? Is it just the regular alpha acids? It's all playing a role in bitterness, but the iso alpha acid is the one that's kind of the most perceived bitterness. So it's possible that we're kind of, at 70, maybe it's really good at extracting alpha acids and not converting them. And so we're seeing more of those in the beer. And that does, fit along with some of the dry hopping experiment data that I've seen from others that kind of, fits with that idea that, there's the IBU is really complicated. And there's some people in the beer chemistry area that, sort of everybody uses the IBU bitterness unit, but no, they don't really love it. But it's still a useful tool. And so kind of on figuring out how can we really, do this and, how useful is the IBU? And that's one of the other questions where, if we can actually figure out the exact number of iso alpha acids, that would tell us a certain story. But it doesn't tell the whole story about bitterness. So, kind of figuring out an easy way to do that could make somebody a lot of money. But, the IBU test that, we do is, I mean, it's, I don't remember when exactly when it was determined, but essentially you're extracting the iso alpha acids along with other compounds out of the beer or out of the wort. And the technology behind some of that is 40, 50 years old that we're doing now, and they're it's based on methods that weren't that different that go back even farther. So it's a really useful technique, but also it's one of these where you can't tease out just one thing very easily. You're looking at three or four things that are there. Even if one of them is the most important thing, the iso alpha acid, well, maybe in a regular beer, only 85% of the IBUs are from iso alpha acids. The other 15% are from other things. And in these hop stand beers, it could be very different. It could be, in a boiled beer, maybe, it's the 85%, but in a hop stand beer, maybe the IBUs are only 40% from iso alpha acids or 50%. And so that's kind of one of those kind of really interesting questions and looking at the perceived bitterness. It's kind of you're getting to the point where, the science side of beer and the art form of beer sort of, collide, and we just both say, I don't care as long as it tastes good.
And adding into the mix, you have I've brewed hop stand beers where I use my electric system to maintain a certain temperature that I've picked over a certain amount of time, and it's rock steady. And then I've also just brought the beer up to the boil, turned off the heat, threw in the hops, and then let the natural cooling curve happen at whatever the ambient temperature, around it influenced. So, that's an added variable that you've got to put in there.
And I can say, when I brew beers at home, I'm not quite as analytical with everything. And I actually did a beer myself that way, kind of did a impromptu kind of hazy beer. I didn't actually even I was inspired by some of your cereal beers. I didn't want to go crazy blueberry or anything, but I was like, I really want to do a cream ale, but I didn't. It's like, oh, I go to the store and buy grits, and I'm like, oh, but then I got to cook them and do all that. It's like, I know, I'll buy cornflakes. And so I bought cornflakes and Rice Krispies, and did a big mash with all those in there, and then kind of just it was a small batch, kind of a 1.5 gallon beer, and then just kind of instead of didn't monitoring the temperature, I just kind of stopped the boil, threw in a bunch of hops, and just let it sit until it, till the next day, till it cooled down, and then racked it over, and it was one of the most delicious IPAs I've ever made. So
Wow. There you go.
could never repeat that, but it's out there.
Now, let me ask you a question. Looking at the data, and you as a brewer, you have to wear both your brewer and scientist hats here. But looking at your data, and I know that you've told me that you need to collect more to be more precise. But what's a good time length for a hop stand?
Looking, I can't say exactly, what's going to get more of the, essential oils out. If you're looking at, bitterness, really 20 to 30 minutes seems to be fine. And so I would, that's what I would kind of, shoot for if I was trying to do that and cool it down more. I've definitely done some, bigger beers where I want to do some late hopping or some hop stands, and I'll reduce the temperature a little bit and let it stand for 20 to 30 minutes. I've had good results there with good tasting beers. It's hard to say, are you going to, at a certain point, you're not going to get much more out of it. So, could you get more out of it by letting it go for 2 or 3 hours? Maybe. I don't know any commercial breweries that are doing that. Some of them are doing whirlpools. Unless it's a huge system, they're probably not looking at much more than 45 minutes. So I think really, you're going to get a lot out of 20, maybe a little bit more out of 30. But after that, I don't think you're going to get too much more out of it.
Yeah, are you going to be risking degrading some of the, the more delicate, volatile compounds that you want to keep? That's the question.
Yeah, I mean, there's that balance. And so certainly longer at a higher, if you're doing just a little bit lower, like 90 degrees Celsius, you probably are losing some of that. I always love when I walk into my little brewing room in the basement and I can smell the fermenting beer and it smells great. But then it also makes me sad because I'm like, it smells great because all that's leaving the beer.
Yeah.
So
we need a rebreather.
Right. So
we need a system to take those particles out of the CO2 that's coming out,
yeah,
and put them back in the beer. It is happy and sad that occasion when
right.
you smell the beer and it's like, wow, that smells really good. And then, oh, it's not going to be, that's not going to be in the beer. That's gone.
Yeah.
That's just like potpourri for the guest bathroom here. That's what
a lot better than potpourri. Anyway, it's hop-pourri. I got to market that now. You gave me a great idea.
Hop-pourri.
So, hop-pourri.
Somebody's run to the website for registering trademarks right now. Well, there's a lot more questions I'm sure will arise. And are you game for answering them from listeners?
I will try. They can certainly email you, and you can forward them on my way. Or if they have good Google Foo skills, they can probably find me online and get to me that way as well.
Oh, but I want to be put in the loop. I want
All
to be.
Right.
I don't want to be.
Then email James.
Yeah, I want to be a fly on the wall to see what the questions are and what your answers are. But awesome! This has been fun. It's been fun to get back together, and I can't wait to see what you do next.
Yes, and hopefully it won't be. I think it's as many years until next time. So.
Yeah. Amen. Well, the line's always open. Thank you, Chris.
Oh, you're very welcome, James. It was great talking with you.
Well, thanks again to Chris. Very interesting results. Seems like brewing is evolving so quickly that it's outpacing the science. It's a good thing Chris Hamilton and Chris Huffman and others like him or them are in the lab working to help us understand what's going on. If you have brewing questions, show suggestions, or just want to say howdy, write to james@basicbrewing.com or just fill out the contact form on basicbrewing.com. And please don't forget to tell us where you're from. Thanks, everybody, supporting us through our Patreon page. Special goodies coming your way. Check all that out at patreon.com/basicbrewing. Be sure to check out our DVDs, Extract Brewing and Partial Mashing, Stepping into All Grain, Low-Tech Lagering and Decoction Mashing, and Introduction to Wine Kits. You can find them all on our site. Get a free Basic Brewing bottle opener with any DVD combo, and you can check out our Basic Brewing shirts in the store, too. You can find our logbooks, where you can track and log up to 50 batches of beer. Check all those out at basicbrewingshop.com. Also, take a look at our silicone pints. That's all until next time. Till then, thanks for listening, everybody. I'm James Spencer. Production help for Basic Brewing Radio and our website is provided by Kelly Dotson. Basic Brewing Radio is a production of Active Voicing. We'll talk to you next time, everybody. So long.